Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Hope you guys are having a great week. We are going to do something absolutely shocking today and just jump right into chapter 14.
Yeah, this is something, this is the culmination of all the chapters that we've been reading so far. So I thought that it'd be really good for us to just jump into this one, give this one some time, and really dig deep into each of these sections and stuff. I think this is the scene everybody knows. Like whenever you think about the Exodus, this is the scene everybody knows. And I think it'd be really good to slow down and kind of just go through this and give it its, its due respect, I guess. And, and also just to maybe to be able to see things maybe you don't see in that like old, what is it, the Moses movie or something, that you see the old man lifting up the staff, and I don't know, like you kind of have something in your mind, right? Like,
oh yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely saw some things that I don't think I've ever, that maybe I didn't even realize happened or went the way it went kind of thing.
Yeah. So we're gonna jump right in. So if you remember last time, where we left off was they have left Egypt. They've taken Joseph's bones, which was kind of, he had hinted at doing that. He was, had that trust in God that he was going to deliver his people from Egypt. And so they take his bones with him, and they go off and they camp at, they set out from Succoth, and they encamped at Etham on the edge of the desert. And then you get this little thing here at the end of the, and then Yahweh was going before them in a column of cloud to lead them on the way. And by night, there was a column of fire. And just this idea that God is with them and he does not depart from them. And he's staying by their side, protecting them day and night as they are about to begin their travels. And so that's where we pick up. Here in chapter 14. So why don't you go ahead and read this first section.
All right. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. They are to encamp by the sea, directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the Israelites did this. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, what have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services. So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots, along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites, who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, And there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? "It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still."
So the scene opens with Yahweh telling Moses, "Hey, you know, speak to the Israelites and have them turn, and have them. It's almost go back kind of thing. It's not really go back. The idea here is that they're going to, instead of just going straight west to east, they're going to swing in, down to the south, and they're going to go along this body of water." Again, I think we briefly touched on this before. Scholars are, it's very disputed what body of water was it. You know, is it kind of the traditional idea of what the Red Sea is? Is it some other freshwater, you know, body? Whatever it is, the idea is that he tells them to do something that's totally out of the norm. You know, it seems like, well, that's the way out. Why don't we go out the door? You know, and instead, Yahweh tells them to turn and go down, and they're going to go down along the sea. And it's just it's a very, you know, it would be very striking to them because they're just like, again, what? Well, that's the way out.
You know? Yeah, it's basically like they've trapped themselves in between this body of water and where they have just come from. They're not on the other side of this. And so it definitely would be like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Okay, guess we're going to follow the fire and smoke and, you know.
Yeah. And so for me, like this scene kind of, it reminded me of a scene from Top Gun, where you've got, you've got Maverick, and he's already like used this move before in the movie. But Merlin, who's his Rio at this point, because spoiler alert, Goose dies. But Merlin is his Rio at this point, which is the guy behind him, you know, telling him stuff that's going on. And he's letting you know, he's like, he's coming around. He's got like this, you know, there's a enemy fighter jet that's like trying to come around on them to be able to shoot him down. And he's letting him, he's like, he's coming around. And he's like, "You're slowing down. Why are you slowing down? You know what?" And Maverick says, "I'm bringing him in closer, Merlin." And he says, "You're going to do what?" And then the line is that, you know, "I'm bringing him in closer because I'm going to hit the brakes and he'll fly right by." And so the pilot, you know, in this scene, Maverick knowing exactly what he's going to do, he has an idea of what's happening. Merlin is just like, "I'm losing my mind because you're you know, like my life is on the line right now. And you're letting this, you know, this enemy fighter jet get closer to me, you know, closer to shooting us down." And anyways, the point is that, like, for me, it relates with that because it seems like it doesn't make any sense to those that are kind of, that aren't the pilot here. And Yahweh is instead giving them this instruction to do something that doesn't seem to make any sense. And man, I think that happens a lot to us, you know, that we are asked to do things that, or we feel like we're called to do things that just don't seem to make sense sometimes. And that, for me, that really frustrates me because I like logic and I like things making sense. And so whenever things don't make sense, I'm saying something and I'm speaking out against it. I'm being like, "Hey, we shouldn't be doing this." You know, I'm like first one in line to Moses to be like, "Hey, I don't know if Yahweh knows, but this is not the way to Canaan."
Perhaps we should go around the body of water and not in front of, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But it's this, "I'm bringing him in closer, Merlin. You're going to do what?" And so that, I think that's kind of what's happening. And then they kind of get an explanation, or at least Yahweh gives an explanation as to why he's doing it. And what's said here is that, you know, Pharaoh's going to see you and he's going to say, "Oh, they're wandering in the land. They're abandoned," you know, kind of thing, that Yahweh's abandoned them and the desert has closed in on them, which is kind of what he hinted at before. You know, it's like evil awaits you in the desert. You remember that line? You know, he's like, only evil is out there. And it seems like the desert would be death. But, you know, ironically, the desert's going to end up being life for the people. But so he's going to think that Yahweh has abandoned them. And he said, "I will harden the heart of Pharaoh and he will chase after them, and I will be glorified through Pharaoh and through all of his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh. And so the whole point of this whole first section of the book is so that they will know that I am Yahweh. I think a couple just the interesting play on words here. We've seen the hardened heart of Pharaoh many, many times throughout this. In the NIV, though, you've had hardened be translated for two different Hebrew words.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those Hebrew words are here. The hardened, I think it's hezek. Again, I probably butcher these Hebrew words, but it's hezek. And then it says afterwards that I will be glorified. That's the word that's talked about whenever he makes Pharaoh's heart heavy. So now it's turned and it's used with Yahweh. It makes this act is going to make him heavy. It's going to glorify him among the people. So that why? So that they will know that I am Yahweh. And that's been the whole point. I think that's been the whole point of this book so far. Not only that the Israelites will know who Yahweh is, because they kind of have forgotten, but also so that Pharaoh and the Egyptians will know, and also the rest of the nations will know who Yahweh is.
And just kind of a reminder here of kind of maybe thinking of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart as strengthening his heart to do what he already wants to do.
Yes, yes.
So I just think that that's an important reminder, because it's still, even for me now, something that I wrestle with when I see it, and I kind of need to remind myself of the things that we've talked about.
I feel so much better with this now. I really do. The more I've seen it, the more I've been like, this is Yahweh giving Pharaoh the strength to do that which he chooses.
Yeah. Which, though, and, I think is why it's important that we phrase it in a different light, in a way that maybe it was intended. You know, we're sort of speculating, and we're trying to look up and see what these words mean and everything. So, again, this is just like a conclusion that we have come to.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's still like I need to hear that over and over again to try to help come to grips with this language, I guess.
So I think I'm really thankful that we've done this, because I did struggle with it. Mm-hmm. You could probably, if you've listened to all these podcasts, you can probably hear me as I kind of work through this concept of what does mm-hmm. it mean to harden the heart of Pharaoh. And man, I think I've really come at peace with this, where it's just like, oh, I mean, this is Yahweh giving him the strength to do that which he chooses. And that makes such a difference to me.
Yeah.
And that makes such a difference to me. I mean, if Pharaoh chose to do something different, I think that Yahweh would have been equally as glorified. But he's going to use his choices one way or another to be glorified.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's going to become heavy. Yahweh is going to become heavy as opposed to Pharaoh being heavy. And so he's gonna carry a lot of weight. That's what the word means. Kavod mm-hmm. Is that word underneath glorified there. And so there's a guy in, I think it's Samuel. I think his name is Eli. He's a prophet, or he's the guy that trains up Samuel, and he's kavod, which means he's fat. He's double kavod, and so it means he's fat. So it's like, that's kind of where that word, what that word means. It's not that Yahweh's fat, but that he carries weight. You know what I mean? Like that he can impose himself, kind of thing, and that he has meaning. You know what I mean? So I just thought, it just occurred to me as we were thinking about it. But yeah, so he's going to be known not only in Egypt, but also in the nations through this act that's about to follow.
Yeah. So as we continue, I thought this part was so interesting as we move into verse 5, of just Pharaoh and his officials changing their minds and being like, what have we done? We've let the Israelites go and lost their services. Because when I read that, now that we've been studying this all in context, I'm like, they didn't let them go. They said, leave, get out of here. I mean, in terms of, you know, it's a different picture in my head than what, if you only read this verse.
Yeah.
It was very, very different. It was like, go before we all die. We're so, afraid of what God might do if you stay, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's almost like they're painting it as this gracious act of like, we let the Israelites go and now we don't have their services. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and I think part of that is that this is when the gig is really up, yeah, that they're not coming back.
Yeah, we don't really know when Pharaoh says, "Up, leave my people, you and the Israelites," when he says that back in chapter 12, we don't know. I don't really, there's not a clear distinction of if he was talking about just the 3 days. That was all that was really ever specifically asked for. Mm-hmm. The 3 days to go and serve God and worship him. Or if it's like, this is like a go, get out of here, I don't want to ever see you again
kind of thing. Yeah, I think he's finally giving in to the original request, which was the 3 days. he doesn't really, I mean, I think he's putting it together. They're not coming back. But now it's, for whatever reason, it's really hitting them that we've lost our servants, or really our slaves. And the point here, I think one of the key words is that, you know, released Israel from serving us.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is going from, whose service are you under? Are you under the service of Pharaoh, who's this ruthless tyrant? Or are you under the service of Yahweh? They're not going to be not under service. They're going to be serving somebody. We're all serving somebody. Whether we like it or not, we're all serving somebody. It's a matter of who we serve. And so now they're going out from the ruthless tyrant to the humble king,
mm-hmm,
right? And so I think that's they're going to be those servants, but they're going to be servants for Yahweh instead, which is just has a totally different meaning to it. You know, has a totally different execution to it.
And again, we've talked about this before, but I think we continue to see the theme of forgetfulness.
Mm-hmm.
We will see it again in this chapter with the Israelites, but right now we're seeing it with the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
Of just, no, the reason you made them leave, not let them go, but like made them leave, was because of the plagues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this idea of them trying to chase back after the Israelites. It's like, you've clearly forgotten what God has already done to you and you're in Egypt. I mean, like, there's no way you would pursue these people after everything that you've been through. It's like, especially the losing your firstborns.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's just wild to me. I think even more so than normal, of just as we've read this in context, how they have already forgotten that. And they're like, yeah, we need those people back.
But dadgummit, don't we forget much certain things hurt sometimes? And even a more positive sense, I suppose, you know, what the idea of like what makes you want to have another child, like you forget like the pain of what it took to go through that, you know, like you have to forget that in order to do it again.
Yeah, because there was a point after Sadie I was like, not doing that again. Yeah. And now I'm like, well, maybe.
Yeah. All right. For all of our podcast listeners.
Well, I mean, we don't know. We don't know.
Yeah, but anyways, so I think both positive and negatively, and we're going to see this, you know, it's like this forgetfulness sometimes of how we tend to push those types of things to the sides whenever, and chase after this thing that's right in front of us. That's definitely what they're doing here. And so they go out, and you have this three-time repetition of Yahweh hardened, or he's going to harden the heart of Pharaoh. Why? So that he can be glorified. And this happens, you know, three different times throughout the narrative. But what I found interesting was this, and he chased after the Israelites, and now the Israelites were going out boldly. And the word there means that they went out with their hands raised. To me, that would be like it would seem to indicate like a symbol of praise, you know, mm-hmm, like they're praising Yahweh. And also they're going out like kings, like we had talked about before.
Yeah. We had talked about how they went out just the front door, how they didn't have to sneak out, how they went out with really a lot of things, anything that they had asked for. And so, yeah, when I first read it, not knowing that the word meant with arms raised, my mind was more thinking about just how they were able to just walk right out of there and not be worried about their lives as they were on their way out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what's crazy is that it says the Egyptians chased after them and they overtook them at the encampment of the sea. And then the very next line, so they go out boldly, and then right there, verse 10, and then Pharaoh approached, and the Israelites lifted up their eyes, and the Egyptians were traveling after them, and they were afraid, and the Israelites cried out to Yahweh. And then this response of, is it because there's no graves in Egypt? Is that why you've taken us to die in the desert? You know, what is this that you have done to us by bringing us out from Egypt? Isn't this the word that we spoke to you in Egypt saying, leave us alone so that we may serve Egypt, because serving Egypt is better for us than dying in the desert? They go out boldly, and then two verses later, this is their response to whenever they see Pharaoh coming with his chariots.
Yeah, it's something you brought up when we were studying this earlier, was just that the chariots to them, it may be like a modern day, like, what if we saw tanks coming over mm-hmm. the hill kind of thing, and like military tanks. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that would be terrifying. And you can, the thing is sometimes I feel like I am a little bit hard on the Israelites because of what they have seen with the plagues and everything. But I don't know that I would have reacted much differently.
No, I don't think so. I think, again, it's the forgetfulness.
Yeah.
Of both people, the Egyptians and the Israelites. Israelites have already forgotten the wonders that they saw in Egypt and what they saw God do on the Passover that, you know, they got them out the door in the first place. So they've already forgotten that. But, I mean, they're concentrated on what's right there in front of them, which is that, listen, great, I'm so thankful for all of your wonders there, Yahweh, but there's Pharaoh, and he's on his chariots, and he's about to come kill us. He's right there. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's always like what is right in front of us that is continuing to fill our thoughts, not the remembrance of what happened previous. And so they, instead of concentrating on what Yahweh has done, they're just, what have you done for me lately? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I find this really, I guess if you were to read it, it just feels very ironic. You know, it's like, okay, so you just want to go back to being slaves in Egypt? Is that what you want? Like, I don't think that's what you wanted.
Yeah, because we talked about this. I mean, in verse 12 of it, of saying, didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? I was like, I don't remember reading that. I don't remember seeing that. And right. Of course, during the plagues, there's a huge gap of time where we don't see any of the Israelites' perspective. We only see Pharaoh's response or the Egyptians' response and God's conversations with Moses and kind of their interaction. And so this may have happened. They may have said this, but really the last we had seen, well, part of it was, you know, where is God? Why isn't he showing up for us and doing something about this? And then the other part was with
the foreman. So whenever Moses first arrives, they go and do the signs for Pharaoh. And then the foreman, Pharaoh runs them out and says, make their lives harder, basically, so they can make bricks without straw. And then the foremen are like, look at what you've done. You've just made our lives harder. Why did you do that? You know, so that's the closest that we've got to it. But I think throughout the whole plague narrative, you're sitting there asking, what are the Israelites doing?
Yeah.
What are they doing?
What are their thoughts on this? Are they like, oh, God?
I think we kind of got an answer. You know, like maybe this is looking back to the foremen a little bit. But I think we've been wondering what are the Israelites doing, and it may be that a lot of the time they weren't really on board with everything. Mm-hmm. You know, that Yahweh was trying to deliver them, they're kind of be resistant to it. It's just like whenever you want to do something good for your kid and they don't understand it fully, and you know, tonight I wanted to give Caleb, you know, like got up to get him some milk before we go to bed, and he starts freaking out because he wanted mama to put him to bed and not daddy. But I'm trying to get him milk. And then he's like, it's like 20 minutes later, he kind of comes to the realization, daddy just wanted to get me milk and now I can't have milk. And so anyways, all of that, it's just kind of that, your kids kind of fighting you the whole time you're trying to help them. And maybe we're kind of getting a sense into that, is that maybe part of that was going on. But yeah, this whole response is kind of shocking because you didn't think that this was what they were saying. if they were saying.
Yeah, I mean, especially because they had been shielded from so many of the plagues, and you didn't really get the sense that after that first incident with the foreman that they were continually making their lives harder.
Yeah.
Like, there wasn't anything else that kind of gave you that impression that, like, after every plague,
yeah,
Pharaoh did something else to make their lives harder. I didn't get that impression when we were reading.
No, but it didn't seem... That didn't seem to be the case. But I think ultimately what we probably have here is really just kind of that small percentage of naysayers, you know,
yeah,
or that are always saying like it's not going to work or whatever, which usually probably ends up being me. I'm probably a part of that percent that's always just like this. Hey, here's all the things that could go wrong with this, and I want you to know that because whenever it goes wrong, you know, like I just don't want you to say that I didn't tell you.
Great for engineering.
Yeah,
maybe not so great for other things.
Yeah. And so I'm probably a part of this select group here where, you know, you kind of have that group that is like, I told you so. Yeah, I told you this was going to happen. And there's Pharaoh, you know, thanks a lot, Yahweh. You brought us out here to die in the desert. Thanks, mm-hmm. Moses. And so that you kind of have that group, I think, here. And for me, I read this, and because we've read other books, this really stood out to me. This line really stood out to me because of how much I've studied Jonah. And so I think that this really fills out Jonah. I don't know that Jonah so much, you know, in us talking about it, I don't know that Jonah so much feeds backwards to this,
mm-hmm,
as much as this feeds forward into Jonah. In that, so Jonah, whenever you don't really know why he fleed. You don't know why he ran away. You're never given a explanation. You don't have that dialogue between him and God as to why, here's why I ran away from God and didn't go to Nineveh. You don't get that. You assume it's because he, like, doesn't like the Ninevites, right? Like, it's because he's afraid.
They're scary.
Yeah, it's because he's afraid, so he runs away. But then in chapter 4 of Jonah, you're finally given the explanation. And he said, and it's because Yahweh shows compassion on the Ninevites after they turn and repent. He shows compassion on the Ninevites, and then Jonah gets angry, and he says, isn't this what I told you when I fled to Tarshish? That I knew that you were compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. I knew that you were going to forgive these people. And it, like, just that line of, isn't this what I told you whenever I was, you know, back in my land, back in my homeland? Isn't this what I told you? And this is the same, like, it's almost like the same thing. But I think the point in Jonah in doing that also just show that he's just not very compassionate for the Ninevites. It is to highlight the fact that this happened, that this in Exodus happened.
Mm-hmm.
This very same, almost exact same phrase of the, isn't this what we told you when we were in Egypt? So for Jonah, it's highlighting that he's frustrated because compassion is shown for the Ninevites, and it's making you remember how compassion was shown for the Israelites. That just as much compassion was shown for the Israelites, and that whenever God delivered them. And so it's making you think backwards. And then also he says, you know, get away from me. Let me just die here. And so that's what kind of is like, leave us alone that we can go back to Egypt, back to our death, back to where we have suffered. We'd rather go back there than die here in the desert. And so I think whenever you start looking at those two passages, Jonah really starts getting filled out, and you really start, I mean, you should pick it up anyways, but you should really start to understand that this is really a critique on the Israelites, of being like, why don't you show compassion for other people whenever you've been shown compassion? Whenever your God dealt with you this way, that he delivered you from Egypt, you sat here and complained in the desert, you know, saying, look, isn't this what we told you? You know, and instead he showed compassion on you and delivered you. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. I think, too, just you talking about it kind of makes me think about how we as God's children sometimes act like we know what's best.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jonah thought he knew what was best, in a sense of those people don't deserve compassion. And here of this wasn't the right move is kind of what the Israelites are thinking. We should have just stayed in Egypt. So God has a bigger picture. He knows what's best for his children. And he's trying to make that happen, and we're just not understanding it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think for what I wrote down for this section of 12 is, often gaining the freedom from the tyrant seems too difficult, and instead we bite the hand that is trying to free us. It sounds just like somebody that's on a drug addiction or something. Mm-hmm. It's like you'd rather go back to the drug than try to deal with, you know, to go through that dark valley that is, you know, the separating yourself from that drug. Or there's so many things that we do this to where, you know, we know that this thing isn't good for us. We continue in it anyways, and actually we'll even fight people in order to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're kind of reverting back to that. They're reverting back to their slavery in Egypt already, and continuing to live like that's their that's who they truly are, you know, that's better for them.
So moving on, the last little section here is really beautiful and much more quotable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
than some of
the, maybe one of the most quoted,
yeah,
in Exodus,
of just, do not be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. And then, of course, in 14, the Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. And this, I think as Garrett and I were talking about it before the podcast, it just kind of came to me more and more as we talked about it, of just how beautiful this is in so many different ways. And I think I would rather you touch on this part.
Oh, why? Okay.
Just because I think you'll do a better job at it.
No, try. Do it.
Well, I guess I was starting to make a connection to Jesus here. I was kind of thinking through this as kind of a life application. It feels more applicable to, like, quote, real life or modern life today than some of the other scriptures in Exodus. You have to really dig for that. It's a little more obvious here of just this idea of sometimes we just need to be still. I think the Israelites are surrounded by chaos right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think generally when we are surrounded by chaos, our response is to fight back, mm-hmm, or take some sort of action.
Yeah, we try to order the chaos.
Try to fix it.
Yeah, we try to order the chaos.
And so as I was thinking through that and just thinking of how are we supposed to discern when to be still versus when to kind of take an action, I thought about Jesus. And why are you laughing at that?
I just think it's like right answer for everything.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I was like, the answer.
What is this scripture about Jesus?
I was like, the answer is Jesus.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about how just in the days before he died, he was sitting there in the midst of this chaos of people wanting to see him crucified, and he chose to be still.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't fight back. He didn't take any actions. If anything, he told the people around him to, like, you know, be still as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And just allow that this was what is supposed to happen. And it was just this beautiful moment for me to just find this connection, I guess, on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's something that has historically been pretty tough for me to figure out, how some of these Old Testament stories connect to Jesus.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, to the ultimate point. And so having kind of that moment for me was just, Jesus is the ultimate example of being still.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the midst of chaos, that sometimes the correct action is just prayer, is just sitting still and just being in God's presence and watching him work.
Yeah. And this is probably by far the hardest thing for me to do, is to watch chaos happen.
Mm-hmm.
Around you and not want to do something about it, actively do something about it. It's very, like, incredibly difficult for me. But yeah, I mean, I think that so when we're tracking, and I mentioned this as we went through the Passover, I mean, Passover is the meal that's being held at the Last Supper. And so since the Passover, these two things have been really been tracking together. You know, the story of the Passion narrative with the Exodus narrative are really tracking together really well if you go read the two together. And I think this moment pairs really well with the Garden of Gethsemane. I think it pairs really well with it in that you have instead of Pharaoh coming, you've got the chief priests and, you know, their officers coming to get Jesus, right, in the Garden of Gethsemane. And the question is what's Jesus going to do? Is he going to trust in Yahweh or is he not? You know, or is he going to take action on his own? Peter chooses to take action on his own. He tells him, hey, chill out. And so it's like, are you going to trust me with this or not? And so these two things are really tracking together. And I think the very next scene that we're going to see is that going down into the waters. And, you know, hopefully coming out the other side. But these two things really, really pair well together. And I think you hit the nail on the head with that. So I think when you think about this scene, also think about Jesus in the garden and how that fills out even more, how this helps fill out that and how that fills out this story. Mm-hmm. And what all that means. Okay. Yeah. So, I'm going to read this next section here. And Yahweh said to Moses, why do you cry out to me? Speak to the Israelites so that they set out. And you lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it so that the Israelites can go in the middle of the sea on the dry land. And as for me, look, I am going about to harden the heart of the Egyptians so that they come after them. And I will display my glory through Pharaoh and through all of his army, through his chariots and through his charioteers. And the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I display my glory through Pharaoh, through his chariots and through his charioteers. And the angel of God who is going before the camp, or who was going before the camp of Israel, set out and went behind them. And the column of cloud set out ahead of them, and it stood still behind them, so that it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and it was a dark cloud, but it gave light to the night, so that neither approached the other all night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and Yahweh moved the sea with a strong east wind all night. And he made the sea become dry ground, and the waters were divided. And the Israelites entered the middle of the sea on the dry ground. The waters were a wall for them on their right and on their left. And the Egyptians gave chase and entered after them all the horses of Pharaoh, his chariots and his charioteers, into the middle of the sea. And during the morning watch, Yahweh looked down on the Egyptians, on the Egyptian camp, in the calm of fire and cloud, and he threw the Egyptian camp into a panic. And he removed the wheels of the chariot so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, we must flee from Israel because Yahweh is fighting for them against Egypt. And Yahweh said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea and let the waters return over the Egyptians, over their chariots and over their charioteers. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned at daybreak to its normal level. And the Egyptians were fleeing because of it. And Yahweh swept the Egyptians into the sea, into the middle of the sea. And the waters returned and covered the chariots and the charioteers, all the army of Pharaoh coming after them into the sea. Not even one survived among them. But the Israelites walked on the dry land in the middle of the sea. The waters were a wall for them on their right and on their left. And Yahweh saved Israel on that day from the hand of Egypt. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the shore of the sea. And Israel saw the great hand of Yahweh displayed against Egypt. And the people feared Yahweh. And they believed in Yahweh and in his servant Moses.
So just to summarize this section, My mind immediately went to one of my favorite Christmas classics, Home Alone. And if you haven't seen that movie, we need to have a movie night this December. So, you know, hit us up on Instagram.
Yeah. Do a movie night over Zoom. Yeah.
We'll see how COVID is in December.
Yeah.
Anyways, so there's a scene in that movie where the burglars or the home invaders.
Home invaders.
That's what they really are in this case. Harry and Marv, which they are notoriously stupid.
They're not intelligent.
Anyways, so Kevin, the little boy who has been left home alone, he has gone to his treehouse by using a rope from like a upstairs bedroom window. So he had like this kind of zip line method of getting to the treehouse where he was going to call the police from.
Yeah.
And Harry and Marv thought that was ridiculous because how could you call the police from a treehouse?
From a treehouse? Gonna call the tree? Call the police from a treehouse?
Anyways.
Yeah. That's pretty funny.
So, So Harry and Marv decide that they are going to climb out the window and just use their hands to kind of, you know, move themselves over to the treehouse. And about halfway...
Which, think about, like... I can barely do monkey bars anymore. I don't know that I can do monkey bars anymore.
Well, I mean, and Marv had his hand, like, burned off from, like, touching a hot doorknob. Yeah. But wow. he had,
what upper body strength?
He had a rag or something on covering his hand.
What incredible upper body strength these guys had. Anyways, they start going across the rope.
Yeah. So they start going across the rope, and as they're about halfway there, they realize Kevin is about to cut the rope.
Yeah, he's got a nice little hedge trimmer.
He's ready. Yeah. And so... I can't remember which one's which. And I've seen this, like, this was a Christmas Eve tradition. We watch...
Harry is the short one. Marv is the tall one.
Tall one. Okay, so Harry tells Marv, go back, you know, when he sees these, you know, scissors, these hedge clipper things coming out. And so they, you know, Kevin clips it, and they slam into the side of the house, which, don't know why you wouldn't have let go earlier. There's... many flaws in the movie.
It's a Christmas movie. It's just,
great, though. It's
just enjoy
great.
It. Yeah.
So this whole moment just reminded me of, like, I don't know that I realized that the Egyptians had this moment of, let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and it actually took courage for them to go in, because again, he hardens the hearts of the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
He gives them the strength to do that, which what they want to do, which is to follow them. But you know, you do see this, you know, we're kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but it's like you see these walls of water.
I mean
like that's a powerful moment,
just,
you know,
to kind of set the stage too of all this. Is something Garrett and I talked about was going to the aquarium when you're little, and you're or even now, but just when you're walking through the tunnels of where there's fish all around you and up above you, and there's sharks, and you're just kind of thinking, man, this would really, really be bad if the glass broke.
Mm-hmm.
And how you would just be like, that this would be even more of a scary scenario.
Yeah.
Of just, I think if I were an Israelite, I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place of just like, okay,
do I go into the scary waters? The terrifying waters that are on the right and left, or do I hang out and see if Pharaoh will forgive me?
Yeah. Or is he just going to kill me?
Yeah.
And so...
there's a choice there.
Yeah.
There's a real choice there.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I would be one to say, if we're going to go, I'm going to run. I'm going to sprint as fast as I can through. And hopefully this was a more narrow part of whatever body of water. But, I mean, that would just be terrifying. And same with the Egyptians, is that to follow them in would certainly be terrifying if you're thinking about what's going on and not just, like, charging after them.
Yeah, but once they kind of have that realization, we've been lured here.
This is not good.
That's the Marv and Harry moment where they're like, go back. And then it's over. It's already done. You know, like, you're already in the trap. And everything collapses. But yeah, I think that's a great little analogy as to what, you know, like comparison to what's happening.
Yeah, I mean,
here.
And just during all this, I was thinking about, you know, bridges that you might cross that would be kind of scary to cross, like wooden swing bridges. Like, I think there's, you know, like, or maybe glass bridges or something that are kind of, you feel kind of hesitant to go through them. You feel like you should go slow through them, but you really just want to get it over with and go really fast. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of wanted to really emphasize, like, the intensity of this situation of just being terrified that we don't really have their, either one of them, their response to, oh, wow, this is really scary. Are we sure we should go through here?
Yeah.
But just that that might be going on in their heads.
Yeah. Yeah. And so where we start with this little section is that, you know, Yahweh's like, why are you crying out to me? Like, I'm still here. I'm in this cloud, you know, and I'm here before you kind of thing. I'm obviously here with you. But he tells Moses to lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea. And so this little moment right here, this has been the theme. You know, Moses has been stretching out his hand and lifting up his staff, you know, throughout the narrative. But at the beginning of the Exodus narrative, it was that Yahweh would say, I'm going to deliver Israel with an outstretched arm. And so now we have this moment, this final moment of deliverance, and who stretches out his hand? It's Moses, but it's also Yahweh. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's these two things. They're not exclusive from one another. Like Yahweh uses his people to do his will and to do his work on the earth. It's not. It was never meant for just Yahweh to just do it all. I mean, that was the Genesis 1 and 2 narrative, is that he assigns these vice regents to fill the earth, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and that they're going to start reflecting out his image into his creation. He's always been wanting to use humanity. Humanity just keeps going further and further away from him. And so now you have this intercessor that is doing and acting as Yahweh. He's the image bearer. He's the true image bearer in this scene. And so where Yahweh says, I'll stretch out my hand, you know, I'll deliver Israel with the outstretched arm, you see visually, you see Moses doing it because he's his image bearer. So he does that in the, you know, the sea parts. I mean, this is the scene everybody knows. And again, you have that repetition. I'm going to harden the hearts for my glory so that I'll be weighty. And as to why that's happening. And I think it's really fascinating here. Compare this back to the creation narrative. If you go back and you read Genesis chapter 1, what you have is that you have the Spirit of God, the Ruach of God, is hovering over the face of the deep. And he says, let there be light. And there was light. And he separates out the light from the darkness, right? Okay, now go read verse 20 here. And it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and it was a dark cloud, but it gave light to the night, so that neither approached the other. He separates the light from the dark, right? And then the next scene in the creation narrative is God separating out the waters from the waters, and how and then he has dry land emerge. Now 21, and Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and Yahweh moved the sea with a strong east wind. So that's he moved the sea with a strong east ruach. Same word. The ruach of God hovered over the face of the deep. Yahweh moved the sea with a strong east ruach all night. And he made the sea become dry ground. So he separates out the waters from the waters. He divides the waters, and up comes dry land. There again, we have this scene from this creation narrative. And so what it is, this is new creation moment. This new creation moment where God is delivering his people through the chaotic waters, and they're going to come out on the other side on dry ground. And so in effect, what you have is a new humanity. You have a new humanity that's being made in the Israelites. And so the scene here is all paired with the creation narrative. And then by extension, you have it compared with the flood narrative, where you've got this separation of the waters from the waters, and they collapse down on each other. So to go back to your aquarium thing, where you think about the water that's above you, like when you go into those weird, you know, little aquarium things, that's exactly what the Israelites, that's how they viewed the world. The Rakia, which is is what God uses to separate out the waters above from the waters below. That's what created that boundary. Up above you, they thought there was just a bunch of water up there, and that the heavens would open up, windows in heaven would open up and allow rain to fall down. And that was God's divine will as to how that happened. So they saw the way that they viewed the cosmos was that there was water up above, and that in the flood narrative, basically that barrier is broken down, mm-hmm. and all the water flows down on top of them, and God quits separating out the water, and he allows judgment to come down on the world. But there's one guy, there's one family who he saves, and he delivers through the waters and comes out the other side on dry ground. And the dry ground emerges, and then Noah comes out of the ark, and he gives, it doesn't last very long. Humanity continues separating itself from Yahweh, and he keeps trying to bring them back into communion with him. It seems to fail at every level. Every time he does it, it seems to just go into chaos. Mm-hmm. And so here we have a new creation moment. This is a new flood narrative. I mean, it is a flood narrative. Yeah. For the Egyptians, it's a flood narrative. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to say that the flood is just judgment. The flood is deliverance. The flood is a new creation moment. It frees the earth of its bondage that it had to sinful humans. And recreates it again. So that, I mean, the flood narrative is doing that. That's what's happening right here. You have this new creation moment where the Israelites go down into the waters, but it's on dry ground. God separates it out, and then they come out the other side to new life. The narrative aspect of, or like the artistic aspect of this is just phenomenal to me. Mm-hmm. And how this is paired with Genesis chapter 1 as well as with the flood narrative, I think is you have to see both of them. If you don't know one, it really doesn't help you fill out the other.
Yeah, and I loved how you were saying how this one event has brought salvation or deliverance.
Yeah.
On one hand, and on the other hand, it's brought judgment.
Yeah, and so, in verse 26, it says, "And Yahweh said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea." We've already seen this. Mm-hmm. Moses has already stretched out his hand over the sea. The idea is, I guess he's on the other side. He's going to do it again. Mm-hmm. But the point is the very same act of stretching out the hand over the sea is deliverance for one, salvation for one, and judgment for the other. It's the very same act. And the difference seems to be on the choices that these people are making. You know, who are they choosing? What are they choosing to follow here? And so the same stretching out of their hand of Moses' hand enacts salvation for the Israelites, but it's also judgment for the Egyptians who are following them into the destruction. There's something to be said there, you know?
Yeah, we were talking and about this earlier and just how the idea here is that this salvation is kind of related to, like, the compassion of God, mm-hmm. the graciousness of God, and how the judgment, how we've talked about in other podcasts that about God's character, mm-hmm. right? How he's gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in love, but that he does, he does bring about judgment, yeah. obviously.
Yeah.
And something that I think was really interesting that we kind of talked about outside of the podcast was that those two things don't have to be mutually exclusive, mm-hmm. and that one of our hindrances is thinking that they are. And we have to learn to accept that these two things, being compassionate and loving, you can also have that judgment aspect with it.
Yeah.
And I think another, this is kind of a separate example, but I've heard people talk about grief and how you can hold grief and joy at the same time. And how even in the midst of loss, you can still find moments of joy and peace and hope. And so I think that has kind of helped me understand, or just how I think about being a compassionate God and also dealing with the judgment that he hands down.
Yeah.
So just something to think about.
Yeah. And I think this is the narrative that gives that line in Exodus 34, mm-hmm. 6 and 7. This is the narrative that gives that, you know, that whenever you read that, you're like, okay, yeah, all right, that's what he's been this whole time. You know, he's been full of compassion and also, you know, not allowing the guilty to go unpunished, mm-hmm. you know? So, yeah, this is the narrative that fills that out and lets you see the truth of that statement about Yahweh. One thing I thought, I just pick up on words, and I always wonder, like, what's the word underlying this, and what does it mean? How's it used? The column of fire, or of cloud. The word there underneath it is like a tent pole. It's a tent pole. It stands up and it holds up the shelter of somebody, you know, of your tent, you know, that you would go underneath and find shelter in the rain. And I'm kind of leaning that, you know, this is kind of a wink and looking forward in the narrative, in that you've got this fire and cloud tent pole, these two different tent poles on either side of them, maybe. That's holding up, that's essentially the shelter of God over his people. And I think it's a wink forward because, well, most of the time when we think of the Exodus, the story ends here, right? Mm. But we're only 14 chapters in of 40 chapters. There's a lot more to the story of the Exodus. And a lot of that story is going to have to do with the tabernacle. And this tent that God dwells in among his people. And so I'm kind of thinking that, you know, it's partially looking forward, maybe a wink towards somebody that's read it before, that's saying that's, you know, remember that's coming, mm-hmm. That you would maybe get on a reflection looking, you know, reading it a second or third time. Do you have any other thoughts on this? On this section?
You mean through like 28 or like through the rest of the chapter?
Yeah, I mean, whatever the rest.
I thought it was kind of ironic or funny that in verse 30, the last verse of this chapter, it's like, and then the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and Moses, his servant. It's like, how have we not already gotten to this point? You know, I mean, it just seems kind of crazy that it's like all these things have already happened, the plagues and everything, and it's this moment where they're like, okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, I you know, there'll be more moments where they forget, but I just thought that was super ironic of it's like, really? Now here we are?
Yeah, and I think part of it is that... me and you talked about this. I think this last verse, 31, serves as somewhat of an epilogue to the whole of 1 through 14. So Exodus is kind of broken up into two major sections with the fulcrum. And the fulcrum it being the song of the sea, as it said, in chapter 15, that's going to follow this. 1 through 14 is the first section, and then 16 through 40 is the second section. Or really, maybe somewhere in the mid 15, chapter 15, serves as the second section. But I think this kind of serves as the epilogue of the first section of that. The whole point of this was that so that they would know who Yahweh is, both Israel and Egypt, and that they would come to know him, and that they believe in Yahweh and Moses his servant. It's just saying that after all of this stuff that happened. And again, 29, it's a repetition. It's restating the whole of the story that the Israelites walked on the dry land in the middle of the sea. The waters were a wall for them on their right and on their left. We've already been told this, but it's a repetition. And also like a recap of this is, if you're going to take something away from it, take this away. Mm-hmm. And that Yahweh saved Israel on that day from the Egypt, and then Egypt was destroyed. And then then they came to know Yahweh. This is the way they came to know Yahweh, both the Israelites and the people that were around them.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see even, you know, whenever you get into Joshua, that the Canaanites came to know them through this very story of the things that happened. And so I'm going to read a little section from, this is a guy named Michael Morales. He wrote a book called Exodus Old and New that's recently come out. I'm now reading his book, Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord? I think he's just got some really good insights on the Exodus and how it leads into Leviticus and stuff. But he says, God's people are delivered, in other words, for the same reason humanity had to be created, or had been created, to dwell with with God in the house of God. And he says, Israel's deliverance therefore followed the cosmogonic pattern identified previously through the waters of the sea, brought to the mountain of God for life and the divine presence. And what he's getting at is that, from very short excerpts, is that they're being delivered from life, from death into life, so that they can come to dwell in the presence of God. That's what this whole story is going to be about, that they can come to dwell in the presence of Yahweh. But first they have to be delivered from Egypt. Whenever Genesis chapter 50 ended, the way that it ends is that Joseph dies, and he's buried in a coffin in Egypt. And the story ends with death. It's death in Egypt. That's what Israel is. They're dead in Egypt, and they're subjected to slavery. And Yahweh comes to get them, and he brings them out of the death of Egypt into the life of his divine presence. It would be ironic that it's actually going to be in the desert that they're going to receive life. And I think that there's so much beauty to that, in that the whole point of this story, the whole point of the Torah, is that God wants to dwell with his people, and he works out ways to make that happen. And he's going to continue to work that out. I mean, Israel's not going to ultimately fulfill that purpose. That's what the story is always pointing towards, but they're not going to fulfill that purpose. And that comes to its culmination in the person of Jesus, and that he enters into death. He enters into this, what Egypt is representing here. He enters into death. He goes down into the chaotic waters, and he comes out on the other side. He's the new Exodus. He himself and his death, burial, and resurrection is the new Exodus for which that we can have life.